On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
We always have tortillas in the refrigerator, and then you might pull out some bologna and some cheese and like just throw it in the tortilla, and you would never do that in Mexico, but you're like, you know, I'm Mexican-American. I can do that here.
That's Bill Esparza. He's Good Food's taco correspondent, keeping us up on all things tacos, from L.A.'s taqueros to Baja and beyond. As the massive Tacolandia event approaches, we figured it's time for an update on the genre. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Evan.
Give us an idea of some names, some people that we may not have gotten to experience before, who they are and what kind of tacos we're going to see at Tacolandia.
There for sure will be world-class cochinita pibil, carne asada, and we'll have octopus, we'll have fish tacos, and beyond. We're bringing like traditional places, but we also have Mexican-American places, and then we have places that aren't Mexican-American.
I understand somebody's coming in from Arizona.
We have Silvana Salcido Esparza from Barrio Cafe in Phoenix. And this year, we have a taco vendor coming from London.
That's insane. You're kidding. Who would that be?
Bredo's Tacos.
What is that?
Well, there are a couple of Brits that have a street taqueria. They've been reading my stuff on an LA magazine and my blog, and they wanted to go check out these places. And I ended up meeting them in Tijuana. I said they were going to go down there, and they were exploring Baja. But so okay, I'm going to be there on this day. So we met up at a bar, and I think we're all drinking. And I had a bunch of other chefs in town for an event, and so we're all out one night. And I think, you know, after lots of tequila, and I think I said, hey, why don't you come to Tacolandia? You know, I just met them. They were like, okay. And they're signed up.
So what mom and pop is coming that you think we really can't miss when we're making the rounds at Tacolandia?
Mi Ensenada. They are a new Baja-style fish taco vendor that a lot of people might not know about. They are outstanding. And they're on Whittier Boulevard. They have a little hot dog cart that's converted into a taco cart. Just, I mean, definitely got to check them out.
So what about someone who represents Pocho or Mexican-American gastronomy?
Chef Thomas Ortega is going to be there. And, you know, he just opened Playa Amor. And he also has Amor y Tacos and Ortega 120 there in Orange County. So he's definitely one of the up-and-coming Alta California chefs.
And do you have anybody coming from Baja?
Chef Diego Hernandez from Corazon de Tierra, you know, recognized as one of the best restaurants in Latin America. He's coming. He was there last year as well. We always have Sabina from La Guerrerense.
Sabina, of course, is the famous woman from Ensenada to whom people make pilgrimages for her seafood tostadas.
That's correct.
So let's talk about our local taco scene. Is there a particular type of taco that we're seeing now that's new that we didn't see before?
We're getting more regional restaurants every year. There's this one place that I found last year called La Carreta, and they specialize in Mazatlan-style carne asada, which is very specific to that town, and we never saw that here before. But now there's like two or three places doing this, you know? You're seeing more of that happening in Los Angeles. At the same time, you're seeing Mexican-American chefs begin to expand and grow, and new chefs are coming in that are really honing in on a new style of cooking.
So a lot of this, when you say Mexican-American chefs, some of these are second or third generation, maybe they grew up with a different kind of Mexican restaurant in their background, and maybe they've gone to culinary school, they've worked in fancier restaurants, and now they're re-exploring their own roots, but seen through a different kind of more personal lens.
Yeah, these are Mexican-American or Latin-American chefs, and not just Mexicans. If they were in Mexico, they would have the same experiences, you know, the tamales at Christmas, the foods from their grandparents that are for special occasions, but then they're all American too. So those foods, you know, the American popular foods are also part of their, you know, everyday lives. These guys have become chefs. They've worked in California cuisine kitchens, most of them, and are orientated to the California produce and products and the kitchens and the and all the chefs. And it's also the multicultural mix of Los Angeles.
So I know that last year we were talking about Wes Avila a lot because of what he brought with Guerrilla Tacos. He sort of seemed to push the whole genre forward a bit because people saw what he was doing and they were like, oh, okay, people love that. You can do that. So it kind of like opened a floodgate in a way. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think Wes Avila's influence is nationwide right now. Before, I think people have always had this idea of going to Mexico and coming back with ideas, and then I'm going to make it fancy or I'm going to, you know, dress it up a bit. Instead of saying, we're from here, we should be cooking something that's from here.
Describe one of his dishes.
A lot of them have a fried egg on it. So you might have some stewed meat and then, you know, some potatoes thrown in and then this fried egg on top. Now, there are no fried egg tacos in Mexico. That's like a no-no. Everything's scrambled. You scramble meat and eggs. You scramble whatever in it. You chorizo and eggs. So if you were to go to Mexico right now and you're like, I want, you know, put a fried egg, they're going to look at you like you're crazy. But that's one of the things that I also grew up with. You know, you'd have a fried egg and you just pick it up with the tortilla. And it's to me, it's like very pocho, very Mexican-American.
Let's talk about that word, pocho, and you have this term that you use, pocho gastronomy.
Yeah, it's pocho gastronomy, and it's also a cuisine that I've been calling Alta California, because to me it makes a lot of sense that this is a region that was a part of Mexico, California, and it always was very different from the rest of Mexico, even when it was a part of Mexico, you know? And so culinarily speaking, you have a Mexican cuisine that's born here from people that, you know, they have a tie to Mexico, but they're not following these Mexican traditions. And it's also just the produce. You know, the produce was always very different here in California, even before California became what it is today. So you didn't have all the wild greens and things that were happening in southern Mexico. And really, this is also the first time that we're seeing a Mexican cuisine in the United States that isn't trying to just piggyback on something that's happening in Mexico. They're cooking from their region. They're cooking what's local. They're going for their local ingredients, and they're using some of their local traditions and techniques. I mean, that's everybody's doing that. So why wouldn't we do that here in California? Why would we say, well, let's be like Jalisco?
Yeah, especially when I know some of my favorite tacos that I've had from Wes have had ingredients as varied as just incredible winter squashes from the farmer's market, just so sweet and delicious and deeply flavored, and uni, and, you know, all different kinds of mushrooms, and just luxurious. They're luxurious kind of tacos.
There is a foie gras taco.
That's true. What's really interesting to me in terms of what's happening in the larger taco world, not just Los Angeles, but we hear about tacos internationally. We have Latin chefs coming here from Mexico, from Baja, and doing all sorts of really high-end tacos. You have one of Noma's key employees, Rocio Sanchez, going out on her own and opening a taqueria in Denmark. It's just a very strange moment.
Yeah, well, I think the international chef community has been looking at Mexico. Matter of fact, Rene Redzepi has been going to Mexico a lot. One of the things they've been interested in are the insects, you know. So they've been going to Oaxaca and tasting insects in Mexico City, and also a high interest in the chefs. And of course, the first restaurants that Ferran Adrià opened up were Mexican restaurants in Spain. Everybody can taco.
That's our taco correspondent, Bill Esparza. His blog is streetgourmetla.com. Esparza, once again, is curating the lineup for this year's Tacolandia. More than 100 vendors will be part of the Downtown Los Angeles event on June 11th. Find out where to get tickets on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. I find it kind of hilarious, but people tell me all the time that they listen to this show while exercising. But I know three ladies who are in the studio with me now who have taken exercising and eating to an extreme. They are our supervising producer, Abby Fentress Swanson.
Hi, Evan.
LA Times arts writer, Carolina Miranda.
Hello, Evan.
And Maria Fellows, who's a therapist living in Pasadena.
Hello, Evan.
You ladies are running the Hollywood Half Marathon next month, and to get in shape for it, you've developed a rather strange training program.
Yeah, this is a half marathon training regimen that is somewhat centered around getting to know LA and a lot centered around food. So we mapped routes for our long runs once a week. We would have to run 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 miles, and we would map a route that would end up at a restaurant that we wanted to eat at.
And I understand that this idea was born over food and drinks.
Yes, it was born over burritos, a large burrito from El Atacor.
The porno burrito.
The porno burrito.
The infamous porno burrito.
That's the super burrito from El Atacor, which Jonathan Gold dubbed the porno burrito. So you ran there, and we're eating one of those burritos.
And we decided that we needed to do this for every single training run because we had to run, these long runs that got up to 13 miles.
Where did you go?
We ate noodles in the San Gabriel Valley. We ate sour cream and
caviar.
And caviar omelet at the Beverly Hills Hotel. I mean, I think the idea was finding a food place in each of these neighborhoods that we ran in, which varied from Compton to Beverly Hills to Santa Monica to Pasadena, that were just kind of the neighborhood.
Maria, did you have a favorite run?
I did. I loved actually the Glendora run because of the mountains, just running around that area and having that in the morning just felt like a great scenery. And then in terms of the people, the Compton one was the best one. There are people who were saying hello to us all the way through, kids joining us, you know, to run with us.
And that's incredible.
Yeah, it was great.
And where did you end up eating?
That was a Bledsoe's, right?
Bledsoe's barbecue, rib tips, and potato salad. Let me tell you, there's nothing as motivating for getting through a 10-mile run than thinking that the Bledsoe's rib tips lie at the end of it.
So, Abby, I know that you ran with your recorder, so let's play some tape.
Beginning workout.
It is 5 o'clock in the effing morning. We are in Pasadena in a pea soup fog.
We are in Compton, California. We're going to do 9.42 miles past Compton's major sites. The route is going to take us 11.25 miles. We're going to do the Sunset Strip. Then we're going to come down La Cienega. We're going to run past Cedar Sinai, where Madonna got her hernia operation. Then we're going to run along Burton towards the police station, Beverly Hills Cop. Today we are in Glendora, California, where we are going to run an 8-mile loop through the foothills, ending up at the Donut Man. The restaurant is on Valley Boulevard in Alhambra, so our goal is China Tasty, hand-cut noodles, 8 miles.
Basically, it was planned around the Lucky Boy so that we could get a breakfast burrito after.
Oh, we're just running. We're doing a 10-mile run.
And then we're going to eat barbecue.
Then we're going to eat barbecue. Yeah.
Have a good one.
Thanks.
This is Route 66, right?
Yes. Those are parrots?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The flock of parrots.
Here they come.
You are now about to witness the strength of
Skateland.
That's the Martin Luther King Memorial. We're at the Civic Center.
Uh-huh.
It was designed by a modernist architect. It's like one of the iconic, like, Compton pieces of architecture. Oh, here's the witch house. This is the Beverly Hills witch house.
Yes, it is. Pausing workout.
Okay. And it was used as a set for the Hansel and Gretel movie, like, way back.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's awesome. Look at those gables.
I know.
Time, 1 hour, 10 minutes, 6 seconds.
Ow!
Oh,
let's say move that rock.
Oh,
you okay?
Yeah.
Knot is rolling out my nose and my legs are burning.
We are now going up a hill.
Okay.
at mile 10.
I need to. No!
San Marino, you're killing us here.
You're killing us.
I am so glad I didn't drink any booze last night.
And we are about to land at Tokyo Fried Chicken for our post 6 mile run victuals. Yes.
Workout completed. Distance 12.68 miles. Time 2 hours 20 minutes 2 seconds. Average pace 0.3.
Wow.
Pausing workout.
I feel like I'm dying.
Yeah. My butt. I can feel my butt.
Hip muscles.
So where do you leave your car? Or do you Uber back?
Often we did a loop run. So we would park the car one place and then we would run, like for Compton.
Compton was almost 10 miles. It was 9.5 miles. And then what I would, I was the mapper. And so I would map a route that would take us, you know, around the city's main site. So we went to visit a tree that dates back to the era of the ranchos. We drove, we ran by a historic cemetery. We ran by the old skating rink where NWA first got their start. We ran by the Martin Luther King Memorial. And so the runs were as much an opportunity to just kind of see a neighborhood as to just visit the sites.
Let's get to the food. Here's some of what you tasted.
Could I get a 2 strawberry, a maple bar, and a plain curler, please?
The sour cream and caviar omelet.
Coffee?
Yes, please.
You only have rib tips, right? Can we get a pound and a half? Is there enough?
Of what?
Rib tips?
Yes.
Okay, great. A pound and a half. We'll get 1 large baked beans and 1 large potato salad.
Can we get 2 of the chocolates?
2 German chocolates? Can we get 2 German chocolates? 1 breakfast burrito?
The bacon, salchicha, jamon. Bacon. And
what?
One more bacon burrito.
Lo mismo.
Lo mismo.
Gracias.
Un bacon burrito, por favor.
Gracias.
De nada.
Morning, how are you? Morning.
How are you? We wanted to do an A1, an A3.
And little sizes.
One standard and one
medium flat.
Yeah.
Is medium flat?
Okay, yeah.
These are really long noodles.
They are.
This is the operation.
Keep going on for miles and miles.
What do you guys think? Mm. Very rich.
Yeah. It was worth the 8 miles.
It was definitely worth the 8 miles. It's really good.
Wow. So I have to ask, what was the most delicious thing you ate? Carolina.
I would have to go with the donuts at Donut Man in Glendora. I mean, we had a lot of amazing meals, but we got there and they had these donuts called a tiger tail that were still warm out of the fryer. I believe there's audio of us going crazy over the donuts, which I'm sure is really embarrassing, but they just literally melted in your mouth.
Oh, the tiger tail's hot. Oh.
Whoa.
And it's really hot.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. This is worth all the uphill. This was worth the 400 feet of ascent.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Holy moly. I mean, the fact that it's hot.
Mm-hmm.
You guys, I think I just orgasmed in my mouth. I definitely did. That is one freaking good tiger tail.
Mm-hmm. I think we need to finish it up.
While we had a lot of delicious meals, I think that was a slightly transcendent experience, especially when you have all that sugar going into your system after a long run.
And what about for you, Maria?
The hand-pulled noodles in China Tasty. Oh, that was delicious. That was the best one for me. Yeah, I think the broth. I mean, I've had a lot of sort of pho, but the broth, I just remember we kept, you know, sipping it, and this is so delicious. So that was definitely my favorite.
And you, Miss Abby?
I'm going to go with the Tokyo Fried Chicken and the collards that we ate with chopsticks in Monterey Park, because I'm a real fried chicken snob and a Southern food snob. And I was, you know, very unsure going in after running 6 miles. But yeah, you ate that fried chicken with a plastic glove and collards and mac and cheese with chopsticks. And it was excellent.
I'm just astounded that you've done this. You've run more than 100 miles together in the past couple months. The longest, I understand, was 13 miles in Pasadena, which started at 5 a.m. That is just so masochistic, I don't even know what to say. And it sounded kind of painful in that montage that we heard at the top of this segment. Did you ever want to just say, okay, I'm done. This is a really great intellectual exercise, but I can't deal with it?
I think, you know, what's interesting about this whole thing for me is I've done 10Ks before, but I'd never done a half marathon. But I think, first of all, being able to run with these ladies who are just funny and great company on a run. But I think the double combination of going to different parts of the city so that the sights never got boring, we never saw the same thing twice, combined with this sort of food goal at the end of it, just made it like this event that I would really look forward to during the week. That it almost, like last night we ran almost 11 miles around Santa Monica and none of us really thought about it, I don't think. We were just like, all right, let's do this, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think the food motivation at the end was what changed it for me. I've actually run quite a few marathons, but that was when in my 30s. And now, you know, when I was trying to run by myself, I couldn't go past 6 miles anymore. I was like, okay, this is enough. But with this experience, okay, I got back into it, and the food was, that was the key.
I think we're the only half marathon trainers who put on weight during the whole training episode.
I was actually going to ask you that, even though I shouldn't. It shouldn't be about that. It should just be about health, right?
No, it's all muscle, I'm sure.
I'm going to toe that line for you guys.
Thank you.
It is healthy. I mean, I've put on a couple more pounds, but I can run 13 miles. I'm healthy.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah, the running. I mean, now when I do the short distances, I had never been able to get over 6 miles. And now for me to run 5 or 6 miles, it's like, yeah, no problem. You know, after doing 13, you're like, six seems like a walk in the park. So you do get healthy, even if you maybe like carrying a little bit more donut weight than.
Yeah, there's always a breakfast burrito at the end of the tunnel.
Well, good luck on the rest of the training program, and I'll meet you at the Hollywood Half Marathon finish line on April 9th with refreshments. Check out where Maria Carolina and Abby ran and ate on the Good Food blog. Next, we head to downtown LA for some seriously addictive lemongrass chicken. Stay close.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. So far in this week's show, we've covered tacos, barbecue in Compton, hand-pulled noodles in the San Gabriel Valley, and Japanese fried chicken in Monterey Park. Now, I'm with Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. So where are you taking us?
Going to the Little Sister downtown, a restaurant everybody in the world seems to like.
This is the second Little Sister, right?
It is. The first is in Manhattan Beach.
And who's the chef?
Tin Vong, who also has several other restaurants in the South Bay, I think one in Culver City. And I guess ostensibly the Little Sister downtown is the same as the one in Manhattan Beach, but it doesn't seem the same at all.
Why?
First of all, the people I know who are the most like addicted to it, like Amy Scattergood, the food editor at the Times, goes there because of the congee in the morning. It's pretty good congee. It's a little looser than you're used to, perhaps. And the condiments are a little bit spare. But the one I like is probably the least characteristic, which is the roast duck congee, which has that flavor of roast duck stock that's been cooked in a long time. And there's a ducky pungency to it, you know, little bits of meat. It's a good breakfast.
Are there sort of a greatest hits of Little Sister?
Probably the best dish there is the lemongrass chicken, which isn't the stir fry that, you know, you've had at every Vietnamese restaurant you've ever been to. But it's like popcorn chicken, I guess, tossed with chopped herbs, and there's crisp bits of fried garlic or fried shallots. It's spicy. There's a nice spicy dressing on it. And it's just impossible to stop eating. It's really good.
What about his rice dishes?
Some of the rice dishes are quite good. There's one I especially like with pork that's been braised with coconut. And there's what must be half a dozen hard-boiled quail eggs that's sort of spooned over rice. Some of the things that that Vung does really well involves fermentation, which is obviously really big in Southeast Asian food, and which he seems to handle really nicely. So, you know, you can get side dishes of like pickled cabbage with peanuts or thousand-year eggs with chilies to like add on to almost anything for a buck or two extra. There's papaya salad, the Vietnamese kind as opposed to the super spicy Thai kind, that has Vietnamese beef jerky, which is really sweet and not as chewy as some others might have had, cut into like julienne and tossed with the salad. That's nice. And one of the dishes there, I think it's only available at lunch, but it seems to sort of typify everything that I like about the place, is he calls it the SGV bun mi. So it's a sandwich, and it's like essentially like the Doc Beat sandwiches that you would buy for, you know, $2.25 at any of, you know, two dozen places. But he makes his own meatloafs and pork loafs, and the liver spread is not just a little dab. It's like a big sort of streak of just delicious liver mousse, not the usual sort of mealy liver paste. And he layers it into a bun and puts what seems to be an entire order of fried pork on top of it.
Wow, what a luxurious banh mi.
It's not a diet sandwich. And the Vietnamese iced coffee is very nice. I recommend it.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Little Sister Downtown. Text the words good food to 69866 to get a text that will tell you where to find all of Mr. Gold's recommendations. Now on to cleansing our palate. Let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm talking today with Philip Franklin Lee, who is chef owner of Scratch Bar and Kitchen in Encino and the Gadarene Swine in Studio City. And Philip, you're here today. You've got your eye on strawberries, which a lot of people just sort of assume are here all the time. Tell us what you're looking for and what's so special about the strawberries you picked.
So a lot of times you'll get strawberries that are like overly sweet and very almost like mushy in texture. And sometimes you'll get ones that are very firm and very acidic. And I'm looking for one that's on the side of being more firm with still the sweetness, but a balance in that sweetness. So it's not like eating a piece of candy straight. It's got a little bit more balance as far as like the acid to sweet ratio. So today I was kind of taking a look at everybody's strawberries. Really liked Smith's. Also McGrath's Viva Patricia. You know, they're organic, they're delicious. They're both really, you know, really, really bright and vibrant red. And they're both actually, you know, they're good size for what I want to do with them too.
So what are you going to do with them?
I'm actually going to do a dish that I've been playing with for quite a while. It's called strawberries and champagne. And one, we're going to do a gazpacho. So we're actually going to take some really good strawberries, you know, just cut the greens off, just the very, very greens, leaving even a little bit of that kind of that root, that butt. That tends to kind of discolor just a little bit. Throw them in a blender with some fresh basil. I like Thai basil. A little bit of mint, fresh lemon juice, a little bit of salt. And then start blending that. And once that gets nice and smooth, start thinning it out with some champagne.
Right in the blender.
Right in the blender. So it's almost like an adult Jamba Juice kind of thing.
And do you drink it or eat it with a spoon?
So that's actually going to be the sauce for the dish. So what we're going to do for the actual dish itself is we're going to take two strawberries, two nice big ones, slice the butt off, and then just slice them really thin and shingle them out on the plate, stand them up. And then we make pickled cucumber noodles. So basically we make a marinade with a distilled vinegar, lemon, obviously just a little bit of water to cut through, little bit of salt and cayenne. And then we'll make noodles out of cucumbers on a rotary slicer and then marinate those in that marinade. We'll cut those up, put those in between the two strawberries, top a little bit of roasted pecans, some red onions that we cook in a little bit of lime juice, some fresh Granny Smith apples, some figs when we can get them. We have a tree at the restaurant. So, and then we'll top that with a little bit of wild arugula, just dressed with a little bit of olive oil, lemon juice, and sea salt. And then table side, we'll pour the strawberry and champagne gazpacho, like a little moat, right around the dish. It's really neat.
Oh, it sounds like just a meal in itself. It's fabulous. That was Philip Franklin Lee, and he's chef owner of Scratch Bar and Kitchen in Encino and also the Gadarene Swine in Studio City, inspiring us to taste more at the market. I'm talking now with McKay Smith, who's a second-generation farmer who's been coming to the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market for over 20 years, let's say. Philip was talking about the strawberries you grow. So tell us, you're the farmer, you grow down in Orange County. Tell us what kinds of strawberries you grow, why you grow those varieties of strawberries, and what the difference is.
Well, we grow five different varieties of strawberries. Our main variety is called Camarosa. It's an older, an old-time variety that we've grown for probably 30 years. It does particularly well in our area. It's really sweet. It has a really nice deep red color. We also grow Monterey, and we grow a couple new varieties called Petaluma and El Cabrillo and Via Patricia. And those beans that we sell at farmers markets, we tend to go for varieties that are extremely sweet. Maybe the shipping quality won't be as good as some of the newer varieties, but the eating quality is top-notch.
Do you personally taste these before you decide to plant them?
I do. We do. We do a lot of sampling, and we look at when the production starts. Strawberry season is a long season. It's 4 or 5 months long. So we look at varieties that produce a little earlier when people are really anxious for strawberries, like in January and February.
Are the plants planted every year, or can they bear 2 and 3 years in a row?
They do both. We plant ours yearly. You end up having a larger fruit. What it does, when we plant our berries in early October, the plants are actually dug up. We get our plants from Northern California, where they're actually dormant. So when they dig the plants up in September, in mid to late September, they ship them down to us. We plant them in early October. And the plants are fooled into thinking it's springtime. So we get those very early berries, like right after Christmas. And they're usually, if you plant the annual crop, you'll get a really nice large berry.
How do you maintain the flavor and quality of the ones you grow?
Well, we grow certified organic. We use a lot of different techniques in doing that. We use predator bugs, predator mites specifically. Where you're not allowed to use a lot of the synthetic sprays that corporate farms use. So there's a lot of tricks to the trade. We have habitats that are in the perimeters of the farm.
We know that methyl bromide, the soil fumigant, has been banned for many, many years. And there's a problem with underground, I guess, nematodes and things. So how do you make sure that your berries won't get eaten up by nematodes?
We use mustard meal. It's kind of a biofumigant. We use pelletized mustard meal, and we put that in the beds before we plant. But we use strictly the mustard meal right at the moment, and we're having very good results with nematodes.
Do you have to rotate the crop year to year?
We do. When you do organic farming, you have to rotate the crop at least every 3 years. So we plant a lot of cover crops before we plant the berries, such as legumes, such as green beans or peas.
Well, luckily, they're so popular and so delicious, and people just can't get enough of them. So appreciate you bringing out those new varieties for us to try, and we encourage people to stop by and check them all out. That was McKay Smith. He's an organic farmer from Orange County. He comes to the Wednesday Santa Monica and our Sunday Main Street Farmers Market here in Santa Monica, as well as numerous markets out and about. And he grows a whole variety of strawberries, which you can try from week to week. Pick your favorite. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find a recipe for Philip Franklin Lee's strawberries and champagne. Fancy on the Good Food blog. In a minute, we travel from Southern California to some truly northerly places. Stay with us.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for handpicked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download it for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Many of us become seduced by the cultural beauty of Mediterranean countries. The light, the saturated colors everywhere in nature. So it's fascinating when that besotted gaze falls on northern climes, that palette of blues and whites and grays. For years, we've known Dara Goldstein as the founding editor of Gastronomica and from her work on Russian and Georgian food. Her latest book is Fire and Ice, Classic Nordic Cooking. Hi, Dara. It's so great to have you back.
Hi, Evan. It's always fun to talk to you.
I'm so curious about the link between your professional life teaching Russian and your embrace of the Nordic countries. Was the Soviet Union actually your entry point into Scandinavia?
Yes, it's my gateway drug to so many things, I have to say. Every time I tried to go there early on when it was still considered the evil empire and very difficult to travel to, there were complications, and I wasn't accepted into a program, or I didn't get a visa, things like that. And so both times I was able to go to Scandinavia instead because I thought I could travel there quickly as a tourist, which in fact I could. But what happened was this fabulous new world opened up to me, first in Finland and then in Sweden.
I know that I fell in love with Italy while on a train, eavesdropping on these grown men who were debating the merits of the proper way to make spaghetti amatriciana. Did you have a particular moment that you remember when you fell really hard?
I know it sounds as though I'm romanticizing it, and perhaps I am, but I really think it was that first morning waking up in Finland. It was midsummer, and I sat down to a rhubarb compote, really thick, fresh cream, a pudding of grains, and I just was smitten. They were flavors I hadn't tasted before.
So let's talk about rhubarb for a minute, because I've noticed over the years that rhubarb is very important in Scandinavian cooking. Is it the sharpness that's so craved?
I think that's part of it, just because it gives a really nice sour flavor, and there's a lot of interplay between sweet and sour. But I think even more than that is it's one of the first things to ripen in the spring, and it's these beautiful ruby stalks. And so it, I think, is beloved for that as well.
How else is it used besides in compote form?
One of my favorite recipes in the book is for a rhubarb cordial. And basically what you do is you just put some rhubarb in a pan with some water and sugar and cook it down and then strain the rhubarb itself out, and you can eat that as the compote. But you have this beautiful syrup that's quite concentrated. And then you add that to 3 parts water or sparkling water, and it's really a gorgeous summertime drink.
Oh, that sounds so good.
There's a recipe for what's called a Tosca cake that has a beautiful caramel almond topping. It's a Swedish, somewhat similar to a buttery coffee cake. And you can add rhubarb to that to give it a nice sour tang.
This interplay of light and dark and summer, the warmth of summer, and the cold of winter really fascinates me. And I'm wondering how it plays out through food culture.
It's almost cliche now that people think about seasons and seasonality, but it's the way that life was structured for so many years. And when you have a very short growing season, you relish the fresh things that come out of the earth, whether they're gathered like mushrooms and berries, and it's kind of a cultural institution in the Scandinavian countries to go out and forage. It's not that it's just kind of a hipster thing to do. And these beautiful cultivated fruits in particular, because there is so much sun, 24 hours in the far north, even Mediterranean herbs like tarragon have extraordinary depth of flavor. So you have these riches of summer, and then suddenly by mid-August, it's already starting to get cool. So you have to think about preserving them through salting or smoking or brining. And so there is a wonderful interplay between really fresh flavors of summer and then the intense, more pungent flavors of the rest of the year that have been transformed through different methods of processing.
One of my favorite spices is juniper.
I love juniper.
Me too, and most people think of it only in the context of gin. But there's so much you can do with it, and it has such a wildness about it. How does it play out in Scandinavian food?
It's gathered in the fall when the berries ripen, and then you allow them to dry. What I like is that they have a resinous quality to them, so you really have that scent of the woods that you're talking about, but there's also a kind of muskiness to them. So if you throw juniper berries into stews, for example, instead of using allspice, it gives that kind of forest flavor to it. You can infuse vodka with some juniper. You can mash it with butter, and it's a really beautiful spread for a very dark rye, and it balances the kind of sweetness of the grain with this forest scent.
Oh, I have to do that. Over the years, most of the people I've spoken to about home cooking in the Scandinavian countries seems to be centered around baking. How did baking become so insanely prolific when wheat isn't a native grain?
That's a really good question. There's a whole range of wonderful breads that are made with barley and with rye, which came in later. But I think you're talking about the wonderful array of sweet raised yeast breads, like the almond wreaths and the cinnamon buns and the cardamom braids and things like that.
Yes.
So that really didn't arise until the late 19th century, when wheat became much more affordable in terms of being imported into the northern countries. There was also more affluence. People had gotten through terrible hunger of the mid-19th century. And these spices had been available for a very long time. The Vikings connected with the spice route and the Silk Road way back when, and then through trade with the Hanseatic League, a lot of the ones that we associate very closely with Scandinavia, like ginger and cloves and cinnamon and cardamom and saffron, all came in. Granted, the affluent were the only ones who could afford it. But they started baking, and both in Finland and Sweden, also to a lesser extent in the other countries, they had, in these isolated villages, the women would get together and have what we would consider a coffee klatch. It was really strong coffee, and it was a mark of their domestic skills to make seven different kinds of cookies or wonderful, wonderful breads and cakes and have a whole array of them. And then, of course, in terms of what we call Danish pastries, but are actually more like Viennese pastries, that developed in the world of the coffee house.
So delicious.
It is.
I can't speak to you and not ask you about berries, especially in Finland, which I get the sense that that's your true love of all of these countries.
You're right. I think Finland has this wild edge that I really love. It has an extraordinary range, something like 50 different edible berries. It has amazing mushrooms. There are, I don't know how many varieties of bread that are still prepared. And there's more of a sense historically of living on the edge there, I would say. And there's something also akin to Russian cooking, which you know is close to my heart. So I think, yes, that I am pulled to it. But going out gathering berries and thinking back to my very first trip there when it was June and there were all of these beautiful little Finnish children sitting in a meadow and taking the wild strawberries and threading them on long pieces of grass and making wreaths and putting them on their absolute toe heads. You know, it was like a painting, and a very tasty one. So, yeah, the berries are wonderful.
What a beautiful image. So what are some of the things that we can do with berries?
One of the most interesting, since we're talking about Finland, is they have this pudding that is called air pudding or whipped pudding. And basically what do you like cream of wheat?
I actually love the texture of cream of wheat with other things. I find it fascinating.
I love cream of wheat. So you basically take cream of wheat or semolina, and instead of using water to cook it, you cook it with lingonberry juice, or I have substituted cranberry juice in the book. And then once it cools, you whip it for about 10 minutes at very high speed, and you get this luxuriantly light pudding that's also very healthful, and it's this gorgeous garnet color. So that's one thing you can do that, and no one will ever guess it's made of cream of wheat. You can make beautiful soups like a blueberry soup or other kinds of soups, which they'll have for lunch.
So I need to ask you about this. Is eating like a cold blueberry soup strange at the beginning? Did it feel like it should have been a dessert?
I think in the United States, it feels like it should be a dessert because that's not how we eat. But somehow everything felt natural there. Again, it's a summertime thing, and you just want to taste the berries. And the beautiful thing about these soups is you puree the berries, and you cook them with a little bit of sugar, and you can add a little bit of cornstarch to thicken them a bit. But it really is like having a blast of berries in the bowl, not to be too alliterative about it. But sometimes they're served with whipped cream, and in Denmark, there's a beautiful buttermilk soup that you can add strawberries to, and that's often served with little cookies on top. And so it falls into the dessert realm, but more often than not, it could be like a breakfast or a lunch or a light supper.
Wow, that sounds delicious. So I guess I can't talk to you without asking you a little bit about a smorgasbord or the derivation of it and this call of SOS, which I had never heard of before.
Okay, the call of SOS is the butter, cheese, and herring. Those are the initials that the words in Swedish stand for. And you can't really have an appetizer without those three components. And probably the herring would go in first place, the herring, the cheese, and the butter. But my friends like to say it's herring, cheese, and schnapps, which also begins with an S, because you can't really enjoy the herring without the aquavit or something a little more potent. But the idea of the smorgasbord is really a fairly modern invention. It used to be, it was called a brännvinsbord, which was an array of different brandies that were set out. Again, think of the harsh climate and people traveling long distances and wanting to come someplace and be warmed. And then over the course of the 19th century, food began to be added to it more frequently. And the name really comes from this idea of the smörgås, which is a sandwich, and the sandwich table. But it was more institutionalized in the 1960s by a very well-known Stockholm restaurateur who made five different trips to the smorgasbord table, kind of de rigueur, and you have to do them in order, and it always starts with His Majesty the Herring. And from there, it can move to cold seafoods and salads. And then there are also hot dishes and ending with something sweet.
So you have a recipe in the book called West Coast salad, which I find kind of hilarious because when I think of West Coast salad, I have an image in my head of a very California salad.
Yes.
This is quite different. Could you describe it?
Yes, it really depends on having achingly fresh seafood. If you try it without good seafood, it's just going to taste as mediocre as the seafood. But if you have access to a beautiful fresh crab and shrimp, preferably the bay shrimp that are small and sweet, and mussels, and sometimes oysters are added, but you mix them together and you serve them with some lettuce. Some people add some hard-boiled egg. Sometimes people add a little bit of tomato, which, as you can imagine, is not exactly traditional. And it's served with a sauce that is a little bit like Russian dressing. You know, it's a tomato and mayonnaise sauce, and you put that on the side, but then you dress the whole thing with a vinaigrette. And it's a very light seafood salad that's absolutely delicious. And it's the west coast of Sweden or the west coast of Norway.
That was Dara Goldstein. Her new book is Fire and Ice. And you can find a recipe for West Coast salad on the Good Food blog. Up next, we learn about a dish eaten all over South Africa during the Easter holiday. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Sunday is Easter. While many Americans will pull up to tables laden with glazed, spiral-sliced ham, or maybe a roasted leg of lamb coated in herbs, in Cape Town, South Africa, the aroma of sweet and sour pickled fish is in the air. To learn more, we called writer Alana Sharlin Stone. Her blog is Finding Umami in Cape Town. Hi, Alana.
Hi, Evan.
Pickled fish for Easter. It sounds a little strange to me. Where did it come from originally?
Cape Town has a melting pot cuisine that's a combination of indigenous people who lived here before it was colonized and the European settlers who were mostly Dutch and slaves who were brought from the East Indies to service what was then a new settlement in the Cape. And the cuisine kind of melded together from all of these influences. And pickled fishes is an example of one dish that kind of comes out of all of that. Pickling fish has always been a way of preserving fish. It's done in a unique way in the Cape in that it's pickled with spices from the Cape Malay heritage.
What is the dish called?
It is just called pickled fish, but when you talk about pickled fish here, it's just implied that it includes curry. And it's a dish with a yellow hue that's laden with turmeric. It contains either curry powder or masala and bay leaves. Those are the fundamental spices and seasonings that are in the dish. But it's not a hot dish. It's just a spicy dish.
Is there something else in the dish that gives it a bit of sweetness? Because I understand this is sweet and sour.
Yeah, there is. It's pickled with vinegar, and then sugar is added for that sweetness. So it definitely has a sweet and sour flavor to it.
I should probably say that you were my executive chef at Angeli for many years. And you and I made a dish very similar to this over the years for Passover, called pesce and carpione, which is a Venetian dish.
That's right. It is really almost exactly the same method and the same ingredients, except for the exotic spices. Otherwise, it's almost identical to pesce and carpione.
So that means that you're also sautéing a great deal of onion.
Right. Sautéing them until they are soft but not browned.
And then the spices are added to it, and then the vinegar and the sugar.
So I understand that the Easter holiday there in the Cape is really a completely laid-back 4-day affair, and that this becomes a default way of eating so you don't have to keep going back to the stove.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that is why this dish originated in the way that it did and has always been associated with the Easter weekend, because the Easter weekend is the only 4-day weekend in South Africa. So it was traditionally a time when everybody would take the weekend off, and even back in the days when there were slaves and later servants, that was a 4-day weekend for everybody. So the idea of making a pickle dish like this that would last over a 4-day weekend was quite appealing. Although nobody can actually confirm that that's why the dish originated and has been associated with Easter traditionally, it seems to me like that is the case.
So it's sort of interesting that there's a fish dish actually eaten on Easter, since fish is most closely associated with Lent among Christian communities, and then people tend to dive into meat once the Lent is over. But I understand that the Muslim population also really enjoys this meal.
Yes, that's right. It's funny, when I started looking into this, I just had always assumed that it had something to do with the Catholic tradition and eating fish on Good Friday. But actually what I learned was that it really doesn't have anything to do with Easter, the religious holiday, or Good Friday, but more to do with the fact that it was a way of preparing a dish that would last over the 4 days. It just became very much a part of the Muslim culinary world as well. The slaves that came originally from the East Indies practiced Islam. So it definitely has that flavor to it.
What kind of fish is used?
That, again, depends on who you ask. There are many different opinions, but it's usually either yellowtail or a fish called snook, that's S-N-O-E-K, which is a fish that is in abundance here. And it just so happens that this time of year is also a very good fishing time of the year. So there is a lot of fish that is available. Snook is a bit of it's a bonier fish. It's quite a firm-fleshed fish and has a strong flavor, whereas yellowtail is a little bit milder. But it's usually one of those two fish that are used.
What an interesting thing. It sounds like a dish that is just made for competition, because there must be all these little tweaks.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, when I was writing this story, I spoke to about 5 or 6 different women who all cooked this dish, and each had their own way of doing it, and each insisted that the other's way was wrong. So,
of course.
Of course.
Have you made it at home for your family?
I have. I have made it once before. But it is just, it's a wonderful dish, and it's got such a nice flavor to it, yet it's still very light. It's still warm here at this time of year. It's kind of, you know, we're opposite seasons, so we're just heading into autumn now. And it's a very nice dish to eat at this time of year when it's still fairly warm outside.
Ilana Sharlin Stone's blog is Finding Umami in Cape Town. Find a link to her piece about eating pickled fish at Easter on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Tse, Joseph Stone, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.